Chapter 24. Kate's knees felt shaky as she walked across the parking garage under the Barbizon Hotel. Every atom in her body was vibrating at a different frequency. Her lips felt swollen from Philip's kisses. Her breasts were tender from his mouth. If she closed her eyes, she could summon up the sensations of his tongue roaming up and down her body. She longed to go back to Philip's warm bed, to let him do all those wonderful things to her over and over again. But there was still some small part of Kate's brain that held on to a tiny sliver of sanity. She couldn't wake up next to him in the morning. She couldn't burn his toast or fix his coffee or ask about his plans for the day. She couldn't let herself fall into domesticity. It felt too much like cheating. How odd that letting Philip do the things he did to her did not feel like betraying Patrick. The two men were nothing alike. Philip's kisses were more sensual. He had an intimate knowledge of the female anatomy. He was in no rush. He enjoyed every inch of her. When it was time, he did something extraordinary with his hips. An exquisite movement like a spoon dipping into honey. There were no quickening thrusts that ended too soon, so that Kate found herself slipping off to the bathroom to take matters into her own hand. Kate knew that she had never orgasmed with her husband, at least not like she could on her own. This wasn't a matter of duration, but one of finesse. Patrick brought her to the precipice, which was nice. But there was no final push that sent her over the edge. Kate was certain this would have changed if they'd had more time together, time to explore, time to grow up and appreciate what they could offer one another. As it was, Patrick's pleasure had always been the central issue, which had bothered Kate none whatsoever. She felt good with her husband. Her body responded to him. There were tingles in all the right places, and her heart leapt and her body arched up in anticipation. That the obvious didn't follow was something Kate had always assumed was her fault. Not because of Freud, but because she loved Patrick so much that the failure must be her own. Kate didn't need Patrick for that anyway. Just lying beside him was enough. Feeling his strong arms around her was enough. Hearing the catch in his breath, seeing the look in his eyes. That was more than enough. They were in love, deeply, deeply in love. And his happiness was more satisfying to Kate than anything that could be done to her in bed. If Kate was certain about one thing in her life, it was that she would never feel this way about Philip Van Zandt. She would never iron his shirts. She would never lovingly fold his handkerchiefs into neat little squares. She would never press her face to his pillow just to breathe in the wonderful scent of him. Her father was wrong. Kate wasn't splitting into two different people. She had fractured into three. She pressed the call button for the elevator. Normally, Kate took the stairs to the lobby, but she didn't trust her legs to hold her. It was 5:30 in the morning. Bumblebees filled her head. Her body was still pulsing with thoughts of Philip. She needed a shower. She needed a quick lie down. And then she would put on her uniform and go into work. The elevator door slid open. Kate eyed the red velvet bench in the back of the car, but knew she couldn't give in. She pressed the lobby button and thought how strange it was that she was still going to work after what had happened yesterday. If anything, the carnage at the Portuguese house made her want to work more. She needed to prove herself. She needed to make things up to Maggie. She needed Gail Patterson to know that her loss was not in vain. Freud popped into Kate's head again. The curse of the psychiatrist's daughter. Undoubtedly, the dead shrink would have diagnosed Kate with masochistic tendencies. Or maybe he'd call it penis envy. Why else would a woman want to do a man's job? She wanted her father's attention. She wanted to punish her mother for giving her father things she could not. She was crazy. She was hysterical. Her hormones were imbalanced. How was it that, completely independent of each other, the male cops on the Atlanta police force and an elderly Austrian psychiatrist had reached the exact same conclusions? They should all consult with Dr. Philip Van Zandt. He was more of a Masters and Johnson man. Which was why Kate was smiling when the elevator doors opened. And then her smile dropped. Maggie Lawson stood in front of her. She had obviously been crying. There was a cut underneath her eye. Bruises ringed her neck. She said nothing, but there was such an air of desperation about her that Kate could almost chew it with her teeth. Kate asked, "What's wrong?" "Jimmy's gone." She blurted out the words like she'd been holding them in for a long while. "He's missing." "Missing?" Kate stepped off the elevator. Mr. Scheunemann, the night doorman, eyed her with great disapproval. She wondered how long Maggie had been waiting. She worried that she looked as obvious as she felt. And now she was worried about Jimmy. Kate said, "Tell me what happened." Maggie took a deep breath before answering. "I got home last night. Jimmy wasn't in his room. His car wasn't outside. He wasn't at the station. He's not on duty. None of his friends know where he is. Don's girlfriend hasn't heard from him since Monday. He's not at his usual bar. We can't find him. We've looked everywhere." Kate tried to focus her weary mind. There was something practiced about Maggie's tone, as if she was reciting a prepared speech. "We?
Terry. Me, we split up."
She kept looking away, not meeting Kate's eye.
"The other guys are looking for him, too.
Terry put out a bolo on him. That's be on the lookout," Kate said. "Has Jimmy disappeared before?"
"Never."
"He didn't call or leave a note?"
"No."
She looked over Kate's shoulder.
"He didn't leave anything."
Kate tried to put together her thoughts. Part of her was still asleep in Philip's bed.
"Are you sure he hasn't gone off with someone?"
Maggie shook her head.
"There's nobody."
Kate wondered if this was true. If Jimmy Lawson had a man in his life, his family would be the last to know. Unless there was another reason. Kate felt her brain finally wake up.
"The shooter."
Maggie looked at her now. There was real fear in her eyes. This must be what she worried about. Not that her brother had run off, but that someone had murdered him, and they hadn't yet found the body. Kate said, "We'll find him, okay? I'm sure he's fine." She took Maggie by the arm and led her toward the bank of elevators behind the front desk. "I just need to change, all right, but I'll make you some coffee and we can talk about this."
"There's nothing to talk about."
Maggie followed her onto the elevator.
"We just need to find the shooter. We have to stop him."
Find the shooter, not find her brother. She was all over the place. The doors closed. Kate studied Maggie in the mirrors. She looked awful. Her hair was a mess. Her lipstick had faded. Her uniform was clean, but it was wrinkled, like she'd pulled it from the bottom of her closet. Maggie said,
"I've already checked the Golden Lady. That's the strip club where the four previous victims ate their last meals."
The bell dinged again. Kate got off the elevator.
"What did they say?"
"They haven't seen Jimmy."
They were back to Jimmy again. Maggie didn't know whom she wanted to find.
"Did you ask about the victims?"
Kate turned when she didn't answer. Maggie was standing in the middle of the hall. Her hand was resting on the chair molding.
"Maggie?"
"What?"
"The other victims. Ballard, Johnson, Keene, and Porter. Did you ask about them at the strip club?"
"Yes."
Maggie pushed away from the wall. She was like a toy car.
The only way she could move was if Kate wound her up with a question.
The club manager keeps a running tab so the boss knows who got comped. All four of the victims were there the nights they died. Everyone had the same meal, hamburgers and fries. Those are the only foods on the menu.
That matches what the medical examiner found in their stomachs. Kate slid her key into the lock. The club manager was certain that Jimmy and Dawn didn't go there the night that Dawn was murdered.
Maggie had stopped listening again. She was visibly lost in her own thoughts. Her eyes tracked back and forth. The poor lighting in the hallway darkened the bruises around her neck. Kate opened the door.
Come in.
Maggie didn't go in. She was too distracted by the decor. Having seen Maggie's house, Kate could understand. What she could not understand was the strange smell of cigarettes. No one had ever smoked in Kate's room. Maggie asked,
"Should I take off my shoes?"
"Of course not." Kate ignored the smell, which was probably coming from the girl next door. She told Maggie, "Make yourself at home." Maggie sounded suspicious.
"How long have you lived here?"
"A year, maybe." She indicated the overstuffed chair by the window. "Have a seat." Maggie stayed where she was.
"Did your father help you get it?"
Kate told the first lie that came to mind. "My husband had an insurance policy." She glanced at the photo of Patrick on her nightstand, and then she did a double take. Patrick's dog tags were missing. They had been there when she'd left last night. Kate could clearly remember looking at the dog tags before closing the door. She leaned over to check behind the nightstand. The space was too narrow to see anything. She wanted to search under the bed, but Maggie already had reason enough to think that Kate was imprudent without seeing her crawl around on the floor in a dress. And no underwear. Maggie asked,
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing." Kate rubbed her arms to warm herself. The curtains were open. Kate could have sworn she drew them before she left last night. She got the same chill she'd experienced on her parents' front porch. That now familiar, unsettling sensation that someone was watching her. "Kate?"
"I'm fine."
"Are you sure?" "Of course I'm sure." Kate changed the subject before the current one got away from her. "I was just thinking if the shooter had done something to Jimmy, we would know by now. You said it yourself, his M.O. is always the same. He kills them when they're on duty. He makes them call in a meal break before their radios are unplugged. He knows that someone will eventually go looking for them, and by virtue of protocol, the first place to look is evident. The last 10:20 they gave dispatch."
"That's not how it happened with Sir Sheik."
"Are you certain that Sheik was killed by the shooter? Why else would he be killed?" Kate could think of a lot of reasons, not least of all because he was a pimp. Still, she picked up from Maggie's line of reasoning. "We can't be the only ones who figured out one of Sheik's girls saw something. Obviously, someone got to the Portuguese house before we did. Or after, since there was plenty of time for him to set up across the street. So maybe he was following us." Kate dropped that theory. She didn't want to think about anyone following her. "Either way, the shooter was certainly watching Sheik when we were all upstairs in the front room. Remember how it happened? Sheik held up the transmitter. Gail stuck her gun in his face. Sheik was about to talk. You know he was. And the shooter knew it, too. The transmitter was proof that a witness was there. All that was left was for Sheik to tell us what she saw."
"Jimmy's transmitter."
Maggie had clearly forgotten all about it. "You know, now that I think about it, what Sheik said was strange." Kate quoted the pimp's words as best she could recall. "The dude my gal saw looked nothing like the brother that's on the news." Maggie didn't offer an opinion. Her face was pale. Sweat dotted her forehead.
Kate opened the window a crack. Cold air whistled in.
Sheik must have been referring to the police sketch Jimmy made. It's been all over the news. It was on the front page of the evening edition. I don't know the slang, obviously, but it seems to me that a brother is a black man. So, what is a dude? Is that a white man?
Maggie rested her hand on the chest of drawers. She looked shaky.
It depends on who you're talking to.
Kate tried to walk her through it. You told me that Gail said that white people kill white people and black people kill black people, so...
Maggie waited.
What do you remember from yesterday? I mean, after I passed out.
Maggie shrugged. I remember everything.
Clearly? As in, what everyone looked like?
Kate crossed her arms. Thanks to the open window, now she really was cold.
Because I've been thinking. For the life of me, I couldn't describe the Portuguese lady. We spoke to her for several minutes. We were in her house, but if you asked me to describe her features to you, I wouldn't be able to.
Maggie shrugged again. And?
And if I had seen her at night and she came around the corner with a gun, there's no way I could describe her face. So, maybe Jimmy.
That's you, Kate. You've been on the job 2 seconds. You don't know how to pay attention to things. You ran into a brick wall, for Christ's sakes.
Kate replayed the words in her head. It wasn't what Maggie had said, which was absolutely true. It was how she'd said it. There was none of her usual irritation. She sounded defensive, and despite the cold air, she was still sweating.
You're right, Kate relented. Maybe I need some coffee to wake me up.
She took the carafe and walked into the bathroom. She turned on the tap, and she tried to shake the feeling that she was missing something very important. She raised her voice so Maggie could hear her over the running water.
Jimmy has been through several traumatic situations in the last few days. He saw Dawn murdered. He was shot in the arm. Surely he was upset by what happened to you. Maybe he just needs some time alone to collect his thoughts.
There was no answer at first. Kate started to repeat the question, but Maggie said, "That's not what Jimmy does." The carafe was full. Kate returned to the bedroom.
Is there a secret person he might be seeing?
Maggie studied Kate carefully.
A secret person?
Kate made herself busy with the Mr. Coffee.
I never had a brother, but all my girlfriends who do say they're very secretive, especially when it comes to their love lives.
Did he hit on you in the car?
Jimmy?
The question was strange. Kate wasn't sure how to answer it.
I think he was just breaking in the new girl. Isn't that why Terry assigned me to him in the first place?
But he flirted with you.
Yes.
Kate turned on the machine.
Of course, I flirted back. He's very charming when he wants to be.
Maggie's expression had gone blank. Before, she hadn't been able to meet Kate's eye, but now she seemed incapable of looking away.
Kate said, "Let's work the case, all right. We'll pick up where we left off yesterday. We were looking for information that leads to the shooter. Let's do the same thing today."
Maggie's head slowly began to nod.
"We can't find Jimmy. But if we find the shooter, then we'll know for certain about Jimmy."
Kate was relieved she was making some sort of sense.
"Is there something else bothering you?"
"What else would be bothering me?" Maggie went on the defensive again. "Do you have a problem with what I did to Anthony?"
"Absolutely not. You acted in self-defense. You saved us. All of us."
Kate had to stop so she could swallow down the emotions that wanted to come. She was standing in that phone booth at the Texaco again, overwhelmed with the need to apologize.
"If anything, I'm sorry. I failed you. I failed Gail. I should have been more alert. I should have been able to help you when all hell broke loose." Maggie looked at the coffee maker. I should have checked the building across the street.
You did, Kate insisted. I saw you do it when we walked into Sheik's room. Both you and Gail looked at everything, including the building.
Maggie obviously didn't believe her.
You told me the first day that you learn how to be a cop by watching other cops. I was watching you and Gail. You both looked at everything.
Maggie obviously wasn't going to be persuaded. She bought herself some composure by picking a piece of lint off her uniform. The boss told us we could have a couple of days off.
So?
Kate was standing right by Maggie when Cal Vic told them as much.
You're not taking off. I imagine Gail would be at roll call this morning if they'd let her out of the hospital.
Maggie smiled before she caught herself.
All right.
The coffee maker was finished. Kate poured two cups as she spoke.
The plan is to figure out the shooter's identity, right? I think that we should go back and talk to the Portuguese lady.
Why?
We can assume that the shooter believes Sheik was the witness, but there's somebody else in that house who probably knows the whole story.
Maggie seemed at a loss.
Didn't you get the feeling that the Portuguese lady is the type of busybody who sticks her nose into everybody's business?
We're acting on feelings now? Maggie shook her head. I can guarantee that woman has been interviewed and deposed by every piece of brass on the force by now. That's how it goes when bad shit goes down. There's probably enough paperwork by now to wallpaper this hotel.
Kate put the carafe back on the burner. You told me yesterday that people lie.
They do.
Then maybe the Portuguese lady lied to the police yesterday.
She tried to make it into a story.
Look at it this way. Something bad happened to one of Sheik's girls. She saw a cop murdered. She got scared. Where do you think she went first?
Kate answered her own question.
She went to her boss, and she woke him up and she gave him that transmitter. And who let her through the front door at that time of night? Who unlocked the four locks and drew back the chain?
All right. Maggie finally relented. It's a long shot, but that's all we've got left.
Give me a minute to rinse off and change.
Kate collected a fresh set of undergarments. She felt a flash of guilt when she opened her closet door to retrieve her uniform. The rod bowed from all her dresses. Her shoes were boxed two high and three deep and spanned the width of the closet floor. Kate grabbed one of the coffees on her way into the bathroom. The pipes squealed when she turned on the shower. She tried not to get her hair wet. Stray nerves fired as she washed herself. She looked battered from the waist down. She tried not to think about the gentle way Philip had kissed her bruises. Kate doubted there was anyone to kiss the bruises on Maggie's neck. There was armor on top of her armor this morning. Was this simply because her brother was missing? Kate felt at her core that there was more to it than that. Had Maggie started to suspect that Jimmy was gay? Was that really why she was looking for him? And it wasn't just Maggie who wanted to find Jimmy. Terry was looking for him, too. The entire force had been alerted with the bolo. Every cop in Atlanta would be occupied today, whether they were searching for Jimmy Lawson or hunting down the shooter. Too bad Kate wasn't a criminal. She got out of the shower and quickly dried herself. All she could do with her makeup was freshen it up. With any luck, the liquid color corrector under her eyes would ward off any dark circles. Kate had forgotten her pantyhose, but she doubted anyone would notice. She listened for noise in the bedroom as she finished dressing. She wondered if Maggie had fallen asleep. Part of her hoped that she had. Yesterday, Kate thought that Maggie Lawson was one of the smartest women she'd ever met. Right now, she seemed barely capable of making even the most obvious connections. Kate opened the bathroom door. Maggie was standing where she'd left her. The bruises on her neck were getting darker by the hour. Kate could have sworn there was another bruise coming up around the cut on her cheek. Kate said, "We should look at our notes from yesterday." Before Maggie could ask, she clarified, "The ones we took from the shooter cases." Terry has them. Kate didn't ask the question she knew Maggie wouldn't answer.
What about the bar?
Which bar?
Dabbler's. The one on the matchbook from Don Wesley's pants.
Maggie had obviously forgotten about the place. But then she told Kate,
My next-door neighbor works at the phone company. I talked to him about it last night.
Maggie looked for a place to set down her coffee cup.
He said he'd put the address in my mailbox. We should go there first before anybody finds it.
Kate wondered who Maggie thought was going to rob her mailbox.
It's after 6 anyway. The Portuguese lady might be in a more talkative mood if we give her a chance to wake up. Just put the cup anywhere.
Maggie placed the cup on top of the machine.
It's probably another dead end.
Gail said it's not a cop hangout.
My father always says if you don't know what to do, just keep moving forward until you figure it out.
Kate slid her feet into Jimmy's shoes. She took her belt off the closet doorknob. The metal clips were in her jewelry box. She saw one of her old watches and put it on.
Do we need to get in touch with Delroy and Watson?
For what? Kate hooked the clips on her belt.
To get permission to go into that part of town again.
I shot a man 5 times yesterday. I don't think anyone is going to fuck with us.
Kate stared at her.
Was that the real problem? Did Maggie feel guilty for taking Anthony's life? Were the bruises around her neck an attempt to quiet the demons?
I'm fine, Maggie told her.
I didn't ask.
You're like a book.
You know what they say about judging a book.
Kate checked her pockets. Lipstick, cash, citation book, notebook, pens. She looped the nightstick through the hook in her belt. She plugged her mic into the transmitter.
Your neighbor seems nice.
He's deaf.
Handcuffs, keys, kel light, back spasm.
Gail's half blind. That doesn't mean you like her any less.
His mother's a nurse. She used to give abortions.
Kate looked up.
Before they were legal.
Maggie spoke haltingly.
Girls were in and out of there at all hours. That's why their house is the nicest on the block. She made a lot of money. Are you ready to go?
Kate started for the door, then spun around and opened the top drawer of her bureau. They had given her a new revolver yesterday because the other one was logged into evidence. Kate dropped the weapon into her holster and pressed the snap closed.
Now I'm ready.
There was a glimmer of the old Maggie in the wry expression on her face.
Check the safety, Murphy. You almost blew your foot off.
Chapter 25. Fox could not stop thinking about Kate's hair. He saw it when he closed his eyes. Strands of gold and honey. Silky wisps trailing down her long neck. Cheekbones carved from ivory. Eyes like the most pristine ocean. All lies.
Light when she should have been dark. Taking an Irish name when she was Hebrew. Presenting one face to the world while she hid her true self behind a mask of normalcy. This was the problem. These frauds who sneaked in under the radar. Then by the time you saw them for what they really were, it was too late. Jews, Italians, cunts, chinks, blacks, Indians. The old man had been right. The world really was upside down. People really didn't know their place anymore. Fox was doing his part to fix it now, but he couldn't help but wonder what his life would have been like if he had been able to put things right for Senior. Shoot the greaseball before he could close the factory. Gas the Jew bitch before she screwed up his unemployment check. Execute the yellow-skinned bastard before he could steal his job. Save his mother from Senior's pain. Because it wasn't his anger that hurt everybody, it was his pain. After the factory closed, Senior would sit at the kitchen table every night, talking about the people who had fucked him over. The kikes, the spicks, the slits, the motherfuckers who didn't belong, Senior started reading the Bible. He took to it like a true convert. After years of deriding Fox's mother for her church-going ways, he found his calling. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. Fox was sitting at the table when Senior found the verse. The old man had thumped his finger against the page and had given an aha that boomed from his gut. Acts 17, verse 26. God had given Senior a purpose passed down from Adam. His appointed time was being stolen away from him. His boundaries were being redrawn. And who were the thieves of Senior's time in the sun? The kikes, the spicks, the grease balls, the slits, they fell like dominoes, crashing down on Senior's world. And then they claimed their final victim, Fox's mother. They were sitting at the kitchen table when she came home from the doctor's office. The Bible was closed. Senior was drinking Jack straight from the bottle and looking for a reason to hit somebody. Fox wasn't going to give it to him. He had just gotten in from school. He was eating the snack his mother always prepared for him. A piece of bread with a crust cut off. A slice of cheese. There was supposed to be a cookie, but Fox knew better than to ask what happened to it. His mother sat down at the table. Her chair was smaller than theirs. The back was splintered. She always sat on the edge of the seat. Despite a lifetime of smoothing things over, she did not sugarcoat the news. The pain in her stomach was cancer. The tumor was the size of a grapefruit. They had given her 3 months. 4, if she took it easy. Senior had started to cry. The first of 2 times total that Fox had seen the old man break down. Fox had not cried. He pictured a grapefruit in his mind. He compared it to other known items. A baseball, a softball, his father's fist. It seemed to Fox more than coincidence that his mother had a cancerous tumor in her stomach the same size as Senior's fist. That was where Senior hit her the most, in the belly. In Fox's head, he imagined the fist compacting the organ until it was the same shape and consistency. He visualized his mother's stomach as a fist. He willed the fingers to open. He begged for God to unclench the tumor and release his mother from the pain. Morphine was the only thing that could help her now. Maybe 2 years ago when she first told the doctors about the sharp sensations, or last year when there was blood, something could have been done. But now it was too late. Fox could not blame the doctors for not believing her. She lied to them all the time. The broken wrists, the fractured ankles, the cuts and bruises, and the panic in her eyes when she was told a wound might need stitches. Nobody accidentally slammed the car door on their leg 2 in a row. Nobody got a 3rd-degree burn on their arm from accidentally brushing against the eye on the stove. You got the concentric ring seared into your flesh from someone holding you down to teach you a lesson. If a person lies all the time, how can you tell when they're finally telling the truth? Fox had seen the truth. The way his mother's knees buckled at the sink when the pain cut through. The shaking hands. The shouts of agony when she was in the bathroom. She kept telling the doctors something was wrong. And they kept telling her she just needed some rest. Fox needed rest. Countless years had passed, and the thought of her suffering still took the breath out of his lungs. He leaned against the basement door. He closed his eyes and listened. The soundproofing was good. He had to press his ear to the wood in order to make out the rattlings of the chains. Jimmy Lawson was still crying. He'd been bawling from the moment Fox took him. He did not beg for mercy. He begged for death. Like the rest of them, Jimmy knew what he deserved. 2 bullets to the head, just like Senior. Or at least, like Senior had tried. The fucker had never done one thing right in his life. It happened after the funeral. Fox had watched his mother's coffin being lowered into the ground. The day was bitter cold. Fox was freezing. No one had been there to tell him to put on his jacket. He stood in his thin suit by the pile of dirt that had been taken from the earth, tasting the wet clay in the back of his mouth as the wind sliced him in two like a sword. Senior had cried. The second time Fox had witnessed this. Big, fat tears rolled down his cheeks. Fox had watched them slap against the tops of his shoes. Lesson 9. A man always polishes his shoes. Senior was silent as they drove back to the house. No one was there to greet them. Fox's mother didn't have any friends. Senior's former co-workers were all otherwise engaged. There were some casseroles from the ladies at the church. A neighbor had brought in the milk. There was a pie from the pastor's wife, but no pastor. Just a cold, empty house that Fox had never realized his mother had somehow managed to fill with her happiness, with her pain, with her fear, with her love. Senior walked into the kitchen. He sat down at the table. He opened one of the cabinet drawers. He pulled out a handgun. He pressed the muzzle to his head. He pulled the trigger. Fox was standing right there when he did it. His eyes had locked with Senior's at the last second. As soon as the trigger was pulled, Senior's eye jerked to the side. It was almost comical, the way he seemed to be looking out the window and looking at Fox at the same time. The gun fell to the floor. Senior didn't fall after it. He sat, ramrod straight in the chair, the same as he had every night for as long as Fox could remember. 22 caliber. The bullet hadn't exited his skull. It had zinged around inside his brain like a mosquito, side to side, front to back. There wasn't much blood. Just a trickle came out of the black hole above Senior's ear. His mouth moved. His throat flexed up something like a bird's caw. Fox looked at the pie the preacher's wife had brought. The crust was dark around the edges. His mother would have never brought over a pie with a burned crust. Senior made the caw sound again. Fox broke off a piece of crust and put it in his mouth. The buttery richness spread across his tongue, then the singed aftertaste. He reached into the heart of the pie and pulled out a handful of filling. Fox licked the cherry goo from his hand as he walked over to his father. The thought occurred to him that his hand was redder than the bullet wound in Senior's head, and then the disparity was remedied when Fox scooped the gun off the floor, pressed the muzzle to his father's head, and pulled the trigger for the second time. Lesson 10. A man always finishes what he starts. The most important lesson? The only lesson that really mattered. Fox had something he needed to finish soon. Not because there was any rush, but because there was no use drawing it out. Jimmy Lawson was still crying. He would be crying an hour from now, or a year from now. Fox was not a murderer. He was an executioner. There was no pleasure in Jimmy's pain. At least, Not much. Fox pushed himself away from the basement door. He checked the lock. He didn't turn around and go back into the house. He couldn't go anywhere. Pressure. Even when he wasn't thinking about Kate, his body was wanting her. Fox held his hand against his stiff cock. He needed time with Kate. Alone time. He couldn't watch her from afar anymore. He had to have her in his house, in his bed, in his basement. Fox would keep her until the pressure went away. He realized he had decided this a long time ago. Maybe the first time he saw her. Even then, his brain was working on two plans at the same time. Fuck her. Kill her. Fuck her again. What was the harm? No one would ever know what went on between them. Senior was long in his grave, buried beside the rest of the paupers. He would never hear about his son fucking a Jew. He would never know about the control Kate had exerted over his boy. But Fox would know. He put his hands to his eyes. The shame hit him like tear gas. The spikes impaling his corneas. The glass in his lungs. The choking, suffocating knowledge that he was in love with her. Love. There was no use denying it anymore. The lightning bolt to his skull wasn't the plan clicking into place. It was Kate, working her Jew magic. The dirty bitch had turned the tables on him. He had thought he was hunting her, stalking her, but in truth, Kate had already caught him. Fox was going to take back that control. Kate was going to bend to his will. Maybe she would break. Only time would tell. Fox had to get her alone. That was the most important part. He had to have her undivided attention. He was going to study her. He was going to learn her weaknesses, record her responses on his clipboard, so he knew the best way to go at her each time. This wasn't like Senior going after Fox's mother. Kate wasn't innocent. She was a liar. She was an imposter. She had tricked Fox into falling for her, just the same as Rebecca Feldman, just the same as every slit Fox had loved since his mother. Fox started nodding. Now he understood what had happened. The lightning had not failed him. This was all part of the plan. His brain had been planning this for weeks. The chains were already bolted snug into the rafters. The soundproofing was in place. Fox wasn't out of control. He had been in charge all along. It was just a matter of bringing them all together. Here was the plan. Finish the job. Start a new one with Kate. Fox reached into his pocket and pulled out the dog tags he had taken from her apartment. The metal discs made a familiar click when he rubbed them together. Murphy. Patrick R. His social security number, though he would never pay taxes again. His blood type, which he'd spilled all over some godless jungle. His religion, though fuck the Pope for not stopping the war. Fox looped the chain around his neck. He tucked it into his shirt. The cold metal kissed his chest. He wondered if Kate's lips would feel the same way. Chapter 26. Maggie got lost on her way to CT. She had driven from her house to the west side 100 times before. But her brain had checked out, and her muscle memory had abandoned her. And instead of finding herself at the Portuguese lady's house, they were stuck downtown in morning traffic. If Kate noticed, she didn't say. Maggie was glad for her silence. She couldn't understand Kate's transformation. She had gone from being the sheep to showing the makings of a damn good cop. Maggie had gotten a glimpse of it yesterday when they pored over the shooter files. This morning, Kate was making connections faster than Maggie could keep up. Every day, Kate seemed to get better at the job. And every second, Maggie was getting worse. She was terrified Kate was going to rope-a-dope her into admitting the truth about Jimmy. Not that Maggie knew the truth. Was her brother gay? Was he a murderer? Could she believe one without the other? Were both some kind of cruel fabrication? Her head was going to explode if she kept asking these circular questions. Maggie had gotten to the point where she was doing all the stupid things that she looked for when she was confronting a suspect. Her hands were shaky. She was sweating. She couldn't look Kate in the eye. They should drag Maggie out of the car and put her in front of a class at the academy. She was textbook guilty. And she was so, so tired. Last night, Maggie had left her mother's house with a thought in her head that she would never go back. She hadn't packed. There was nothing in her room that she needed. She'd grabbed her belt off the counter and walked out the door. She'd radioed a cruiser to come pick her up on the corner. She'd had them drop her at the station. She'd showered in the empty men's locker room. She'd changed into a fresh uniform she kept in her locker. Everything Maggie did had felt so permanent, but she knew there was nowhere to go but back. She didn't have a place to live. Her car was in the shop. She didn't have a dime to her name. She didn't have a fancy apartment with a white shag rug and more clothes in her closet than there were days left to wear them. Terry controlled all the money. The idea hadn't seemed like such a bad one at the time. Delia couldn't open a separate bank account without her husband's signature. And Hank cleaned them out every time he got home from the hospital. Delia started giving Terry her checks when they almost lost the house. Maggie started giving him her checks when she got her job on the police force. And when either one of them stepped out of line, Terry yanked the strings on the purse so tight that it strangled them. There were all kinds of new federal laws that were supposed to open financial doors for women, but they were still firmly closed in Atlanta, Georgia. There was always a workaround, always some catch that kept the door from opening. Maggie couldn't get a bank account that Terry couldn't access. She couldn't get a car loan without Terry's co-signature. She couldn't get a credit card or rent an apartment without Terry's permission. Nearest living male's information. That's what all the forms asked for. Maggie had spent months calling apartment ads in the paper. All of them required a man to vouch for her. Even the sketchy ones. She was too afraid to ask Terry. And Jimmy refused because he didn't want to get caught in the middle. Jimmy. Last night, Maggie had started with his friends, banging on their apartment doors, waking their families all the while knowing Jimmy would not be there. She went to the bar where he sometimes grabbed a drink after work. She called every old girlfriend whose name she could think of. She checked the back seat of his cruiser. She busted open his locker at work. She visited the shooting range. She went to the Grady High School football field. She searched the locker room, the coach's office, the basement where kids sneaked in to make out. She woke up all the managers at the motels along the interstate. She walked through Piedmont Park with a flashlight. She shined her headlights into underpasses and down alleys where she knew gay men went for company. She went to porn theaters and all-night diners. The despair built with each new parking lot and alley. Every frightened, anonymous man who fled at the sight of a police car. Maggie had to find her brother before Terry did. She didn't know whether or not her intention was to save his life. That felt strangely secondary to locating him. Her primary goal was to get some sort of explanation. Jimmy had to look Maggie in the eye and tell her why he had written that letter. The letter. Every single word was seared into her brain. Delia had torn up the paper, but Maggie had transcribed Jimmy's confession into her notebook as soon as she left the house. She'd studied each sentence individually. She had blocked off phrases. She had looked for some kind of hidden meaning. There had to be more to it than the actual words. Because what was the point? Even on the off chance that Jimmy really was gay, and Don Wesley and all those other men had been gay with him, then why murder them? Each held a weapon just as powerful as the other. They were like Russia and the United States agreeing not to release their nukes because of mutually assured destruction. And if Jimmy wasn't gay, then why confess to the murders? What was his motivation? Maybe Kate was right about Jimmy's state of mind. He'd seen Don shot right in front of him. He'd failed to save his partner's life. He'd been shot in the arm by a madwoman. Was Jimmy like those battle-fatigued soldiers who went nuts when they got back into the real world? Was the letter a cry for help? If that was the case, Jimmy had found the one thing that ensured Terry would put him out of his misery. The only thing he hated more than blacks and liberals was homosexuals. Son of a bitch. Maggie banged her fist on the steering wheel. They were driving up 3rd Street, a few blocks from the Georgia Tech Tunnel, and there was London Fog, traipsing along the sidewalk like he hadn't a care in the world. He was still wearing the old man's overcoat, but this time she saw the legs of his worsted gray pants above the shiny black loafers on his feet. Maggie swerved the car so hard the engine stalled. Kate grabbed the dashboard. What are you? Him. Maggie was already getting out of the car. That's the rapist who went after the little girl. Kate got out of the car, too. You're sure? He stole the grandfather's coat. Maggie pulled the nightstick off her belt. She was talking loudly enough for London Fog to hear, but like the other day, he just kept on walking. He raped a 13-year-old girl. He stole her grandfather's coat. She jogged to catch up with him. His name is Lewis Wendell Conroy III. He's from Berwyn, Maryland. That stopped him. His hands clutched in his pockets. He still didn't turn around. Maggie stood behind him. She slapped the nightstick against her palm. Get on your knees. He didn't move. Maggie wasn't in the mood for second warnings. She swung the metal baton through the air and slammed it into the back of his legs. Conroy dropped like a sack of hammers. Kate gasped, Maggie! Get up, she told the man. Get up or I will hurt you as bad as you hurt that little girl. Conroy could only make it to his hands and knees. The baton had knocked the wind out of him. He opened his mouth, but only drool came out. I said get up! Maggie cracked his tailbone so hard that the metal sang. Conroy screamed. His arms and legs flew out from under him. He fell face down on the sidewalk. Maggie gripped the baton. You think your daddy's gonna get you out of this, Lewis? She yearned to hit him again. To hear the crack of bone, the screech of pain. Get up, she repeated. Get up, you baby-raping asshole. He tried, but his arms would not lift him. He fell flat to the sidewalk again. Maggie told Kate, help him up. Kate looked terrified as she gripped Conroy under the arm. She wasn't strong enough. He offered nothing but resistance. Please, he begged. Use your legs, Kate said. Please, lady. Like all of them, he sensed Kate's weakness. Please help me. I didn't do anything wrong. Shut up. Kate let him fall back onto the sidewalk. She asked Maggie, what do you want to do with him? The question stopped her.
She hadn't thought it through.
Please,
Conroy whined. This is all just a misunderstanding. Kate said, radio the girls. Maggie knew this couldn't go out on the radio. She looked around. There was a phone booth on the next corner. Are you okay with him? We'll be fine as long as he understands I'm just as good with my nightstick as you are. Kate raised an eyebrow, acknowledging the lie. She was so damn good at this. When had that happened? Kate asked, do you need change? I've got it. Maggie shoved her nightstick back under her belt as she walked toward the phone booth. She was so furious, she couldn't get her fists to unclench. Lewis Wendell Conroy III. He could walk into any apartment building in the city and rent 10 units. He could buy any car he wanted. He could do whatever the hell he pleased. Except get away with raping a little girl. The phone booth smelled like piss. Wet vomit splattered the floor. Maggie held the door open with her shoulder as she leaned in. She dialed the station and requested a landline to radio transmission. Delroy answered with her call sign. Maggie didn't identify herself or bother with an explanation. Corner of 3rd and Cypress.
Gimme 15.
Delroy ended the transmission. Maggie hung up the receiver. The door sprang back on its hinges. She could see Kate standing over Conroy. Her nightstick was drawn, but she held it in front of her face like a Roman candle. 13 years old. Lily was the same age. She was pretty, and she might even look sexy if she wore too much makeup, but she was still a child who played with her Barbie up until a few months ago. Maggie looked down at her hands. She made the fingers straighten one at a time. She wanted to be calm by the time she made it back to them. She wanted to think that she wasn't out of control like Terry, or a cold-blooded murderer like Jimmy. But by the time she reached Conroy, all she wanted to do was take out her gun, shove it into his mouth, and pull the trigger until it clicked and clicked the same as it had with Anthony. How long? Kate asked. Too long. Stand up. She grabbed up Conroy by the collar. He knew better than to resist. He stumbled like a colt taking its first steps. That way. Maggie kicked his ass to get him started. Move. Kate was at Maggie's side. Her nightstick was still in front of her face. Maggie pushed it down at an angle so she could get a better swing. Conroy walked slowly. His head was down. He was looking for a way out. Ladies, please. We can talk this through. It's all just a misunderstanding. That girl needed stitches when you were done with her. Did you know that? Is that what this is about? He sounded relieved. For God's sakes, I'll pay the doctor's bill. My father will write a check. You're not getting off that easy. Why don't you ask a family? I'm sure they'll accept the money. Trust me, she knew what she was doing. Did she trick you? Maggie had heard the excuse so many times that it made her stomach turn. She didn't tell me how old she was. She was mature for her age. She came on to me. She wouldn't stop. What was I supposed to do? The entire world gave men the responsibility for everything in it, except for their dicks. Maggie pulled her nightstick again. Pick up your feet. He glanced furtively left and right. Now he was looking for an escape. Maggie pressed the baton to the base of his spine. Try to run, asshole. Just give me a reason. I know your names. We know yours, too. Maggie ignored the panicked look Kate gave her. It's going to be a lot of fun seeing you on the front page of the newspaper beside a photo of that little girl you ripped apart. What do you care? He demanded. She's just some damn little pickaninny.
And you're a spoiled little bitch who's going to take a beat down instead of going to prison for the next 3 years.
They were at the phone booth.
Get in.
Maggie pushed him. He hesitated. There was vomit on the floor. He didn't want to get his loafers dirty.
Take off your shoes.
What?
She banged the baton against the phone booth. Shoes off.
He slipped them off. There were pennies in the loafers. He wasn't wearing socks. He had probably paid more for his worsted wool pants than Maggie made in a week. She was sick and tired of these wealthy people who floated through life like it was nothing. She told Conroy,
"Take off the coat. It doesn't belong to you."
He didn't protest this time. The coat came off. Kate grabbed it before it hit the ground. Maggie said,
"Take off the rest of it."
"What?" She swung the baton back. That's all it took. He ripped open his shirt. The buttons popped off. He unfastened the snap on his pants, slid down the zip. His thumbs hooked into the waist of his underwear.
"No," Maggie said, not because she didn't want to humiliate him any further, but because she didn't want to see him.
"Get in the phone booth." He stepped tentatively into the vomit. She'd hoped it was cold. She hoped he could feel the chunks against the soles of his feet. Conroy asked,
"What are you?"
Maggie pushed the folding door closed. She reached up to the top of the booth. She had to stand on her tiptoes to find the trip lock. The bolt clanged down. Conroy pushed on the door. It wouldn't budge.
"Let me out!"
He started to panic. He put his shoulder into it.
"Let me out, God damn it!"
Kate had folded the grandfather's coat. She laid it beside the phone booth.
"Do you think they'll give it back to him?"
"It's not our business." She jammed the baton back onto her belt. "Anything else, Kate? Anything you want to ask me or question me or drill me on?"
Kate shook her head.
Maggie walked away. She tapped her fingers on her Kel light. Her head pounded with each footstep. Her vision was wonky. She was sweaty and shaky. Kate's footsteps came up behind her. She followed at a distance. She was giving Maggie some space, which was irritating and demeaning and just like something Kate would do. The first week Maggie rode with Gail, she'd known to keep her trap shut. She'd taken notes. She'd followed orders. She hadn't asked questions. She hadn't volunteered her opinion every 5 minutes. She hadn't turned every stupid thing she did into a joke so that she could laugh at herself before everybody else did. Maggie fished the keys out of her pocket. Her hand cramped. She couldn't loop the ring on her middle finger. Pulling the trigger. Gripping the steering wheel. Banging on doors. Holding the Kel light. Wielding the nightstick, wringing her hands and praying to God that her brother was alive, that he was dead, that Terry hadn't found him, that she would never have to see him again. Maggie stopped in front of the cruiser. Her chest hurt. She wondered if she was having a heart attack. Kate stood behind her. She said nothing, but the question was loud and clear. "Are you all right? Are you all white?" Maggie tossed her the keys. "You drive."